In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Reports of a sudden increase in COVID-19 cases in New York City has justified delays in the reopening process. However, the news reports don't include any information about how the cases were determined. Was a PCR test used? If so, would that number be eventually adjusted for false or negative positives and other errors? Remember the recent University of Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine study that proved risk of false positives from the swab test? Without a national standard to test for COVID-19, how can this data be trusted by anyone? For months, there has been major public concern that bad science and biased data is actively used to make decisions about quarantine, lockdowns, and business closure. Moving beyond biased COVID data sets, leaked emails revealed how Nashville local city government withheld data that showed a significant decrease in cases at restaurants and bars. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine recently said he would veto a bill passed by the state Senate that would limit his power to impose quarantines. A lawsuit challenging the basis of pandemic emergency declaration responses was brought in the state of Ohio. Our guest, Tom Rentz, is the lead attorney and has spent about 2,000 hours working with a team of doctors and scientists researching this case. Tom Rentz founded the Rentz Law Firm. His experience in law started with Henry T. King, Nuremberg prosecutor and celebrated international lawyer and scholar. Tom joins us now to talk more about this important case. Attorney Tom Rentz, welcome to Another News.
Yeah, happy to be here, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Your lawsuit, Tom, challenges the premise of the pandemic lockdown orders and asserts that the CDC and other agencies have intentionally misled the public. Did you see a lot of hardship related to the shutdowns? And would you please tell listeners more about how this case originated?
Yeah, well, I saw an awful lot of hardship. And I'll tell you, not too long after the lockdown started, I had a client get a hold of me, and I can talk about her case because we had to go public with it. She was immediately post-op stage 4 cancer. She couldn't go to her doctor because of the rules of the lockdown. Her doctor was out of state, and it just wasn't going to be allowed. We called, and we tried to get an exemption. We requested from the state that we get an exemption. You know, this is stage 4 cancer. It's not something you can screw with. You got to get there. They wouldn't give us an exemption, which I found to be amazing since this was supposed to all be about preserving life, right? Well, they wouldn't give an exemption, and we had to have a big stinky fight about it, and we got her there. Thank God. But, you know, it made me really start kind of questioning this. And, yeah, you know, I'd already done a lot of work on this to see what was going on. The numbers weren't adding up. The stuff that the CDC was saying and the stuff that the ODH was saying, the Ohio Department of Health, it didn't follow with what they were writing. You know, if you dug through the website and you dug far enough, it all said something different than what they were saying publicly. So it really made me question the narrative and question what was going on. So I dug into it, and I found that there was a lot to question. So, you know, from there, I got some other people that got a hold of me who were experiencing some very hard times because of this. Whether it be from being locked in their houses, which is very much akin to house arrest, or being discriminated against because they couldn't wear a mask even though they had medical issues that prevented them from wearing a mask, all sorts of things. So I kept seeing all these problems. And meanwhile, none of the data was adding up. So it prompted me to really get into this, and I was very excited to take the case.
Were there any particular lockdown orders that were more draconian in the state of Ohio than other places or similar to a few other states?
Well, so for me personally, there were several things that have happened that were just across the line. Okay, the first was the house arrest. if you look up the Ohio Revised Code definition of house arrest and you set it next to the shelter-in-place order, they're almost indistinguishable. The language is different, but the result is identical. I found that to be absurd. You just can't lock people up without a good reason. And even if you do have a reason, you can't say that an entire population of a state needs to be locked down. We did it when there were only 3 cases in the state. It was just absolutely inexcusable to me. So there was that. The second thing that really got me was actually similar to what you had out of New York. What they started doing to seniors, they locked them into these nursing homes. They won't let anybody come and see them. They won't let them make their own decisions. And I view this as discrimination. You know, just because you are in a nursing home doesn't mean you don't have the capacity to decide whether or not you want to see your family. Certainly, disproportionately impacts seniors. You know, if you were perfectly healthy and you fall and hurt yourself and have to spend a few weeks in a nursing home, you suddenly are incapable of making a decision whether or not you want to visit your family. So nursing homes are now like jail. I found that to be just absolutely monstrous, especially in light of the fact that they were doing this even with hospice patients. If you were dying, you couldn't say goodbye to your family. So that was sickening to me. So the third issue is kids. It's really hard for me to see what they're doing with kids. You know, these kids, they're not susceptible to this disease. The CDC's planning scenario that they just updated shows, I think, I'd have to double check, but I think it's 0.3% of kids have to worry about a fatality from COVID. So, you know, telling these kids, and I'll tell you, for example, we've got a preschool here. And that preschool, you know, they're telling these kids they got to socially distance and they're making these kids wear masks, these kids who are at no risk. All they're doing, the only way to do this and to actually be effective is to scare these kids. Do you really want to scare 3- and 4-year-olds of other people? Hey, these other people got germs, you know, little Sally, so you got to stay away from them. Well, what kind of damage are we doing to these kids? What are we doing to what their psyche is as they grow up? What kind of people are they going to grow up to be? They're going to be terrified of other people. We're going to do damage. So, you know, the 3 big things were kids, seniors, and then the statewide house arrest. They were just too much for me. And then you look at New York, you know, you have one population that is at all susceptible to this disease, and that is seniors, elderly people. And not only do you not let them decide whether or not they want to say goodbye to their loved ones when they die, but you put sick people in the nursing home with them to make them more likely to get the disease. They're the only group of people that are at risk from this disease. And then we put sick people in there. I don't understand it. So, you know, these things just didn't add up to me, and they really, I guess they made me very proud to take this case.
Yes, that was a major story in the alternative news arena for a number of weeks and months, and that is the deaths of those in nursing homes as a result of COVID patients being housed in nursing homes. So that was very unusual in New York City and New Jersey, I believe, as well. I noticed that given the unreliability of testing data, that there's very little to no detail given when news reports on how new COVID-19 cases are determined. And this recently happened in New York City. Reports have come out that there are more than 1,000 new cases in Queens and Brooklyn. How are those determined? What have you found in your research for this case regarding the efficacy of the COVID-19 testing? And will you have expert witnesses talking about this in court under oath?
I absolutely will have loads of experts. And one thing that I want to make real clear, when you look at this, a lot of people are going to say, no, this just can't be true. These guys are conspiracy theories, that theorists. They're just nuts. Well, I challenge those people to look at my complaint and to look at the citations. Everything that we allege is cited. It's cited to scientific data. It's cited to the CDC. It's their data. It's their information. What we're saying isn't a matter of opinion. It's a matter of fact the other side has already admitted to. And we have tons of experts. Yeah, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a doctor. So, you know, I've had to have a lot of doctors and scientists educate me about this situation. what we found is the PCR test, which is what everybody's calling the gold standard, is a wonderful laboratory tool that was invented by a guy who won a Nobel Prize for inventing it. And that guy who invented that test said, this is a wonderful laboratory tool, but should never be used to diagnose illness because it's not suited for it. The PCR tests that we're doing, they look for pieces of virus in your system, okay? A piece of virus in your system is really meaningless. We have that all the time. Our immune systems take care of it. People get a virus in there, they don't know they had it, it goes out, they don't share it, they don't pass it, the immune system takes care of it. That's why we have that. When a virus, and this is based on the explanation from the doctors, a virus gets in your system and it grows. Once it gets to a certain capacity, once there's enough virus, and that's called viral load, once there's enough viral load in your system, you start becoming sick. That's when that virus becomes a disease. So this PCR test is checking for a piece of a virus. There may never be enough virus to ever become a disease. This PCR test is absolutely meaningless in terms of determining whether you're going to get COVID-19. It tests for pieces of SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus thought to cause COVID-19, okay? But it doesn't actually show that you have COVID-19. And there's no way for it to do that because all it does is see whether there's a presence of some part of this virus in your system. Also, what's much, much worse is the CDC hasn't even defined what it means to have this disease in laboratory terms. They put out a bunch of symptoms and said, if you got these, it's COVID-19. And by the way, the symptoms are the same as pretty much any of 50 other diseases. But in terms of the tests, when you get this PCR test, there are over 100 manufacturers of this test. And these manufacturers are the ones that set the standard for whether or not you have a positive or a negative result. So if you take the test from one manufacturer, you may get a positive, and from the next, you may get a negative. And if you take, just because of the way the PCR test works, if you take the same test twice in a row, you may get a positive and a negative. We had that in Ohio. The governor here tested positive and then tested negative twice the next day. I mean, so the tests are absolutely meaningless. And what they've done is, contrary to pretty much any other disease in the universe, the CDC has said, well, if you've got a couple symptoms, you can go ahead and diagnose this as a probable case. And the problem with that is that it's really meaningless. And what we've seen is in the CARES Act, they allowed for an additional 20% Medicare reimbursement rate for people who are being treated for COVID-19. Well, shockingly, or not so shockingly, once they found these hospitals realized that, and that's the only thing they've diagnosed. We saw in Colorado, I've kind of been working with some people on a case out there, saw in Colorado that once COVID-19 came into play and the funding was increased, COVID-19 actually cured the flu. There's no more flu cases because the symptoms are identical. And why would you test for the flu if you can call it COVID-19 and get an extra 20%? So the cases are being vastly inflated. You know, I've seen the arguments in the media about the cases being undercounted or about this, about the deaths being undercounted. And they're the worst kind of lies I've ever seen. There's just nothing true about it. Openly and honestly, these people have said that this is just not working in their writings. But then they go on TV and they just tell lies.
It's really painful to watch those lies being disseminated on television. I really don't watch, I don't have television, but I do read the articles, and that's really disgusting to read. Some of these so-called journalists who are writing this horrible propaganda, and a number of articles regarding an outbreak of more than 1,000 COVID-19 cases in New York City recently, and that it really troubled me to see the fear-mongering in this particular article, right as the reopening process has begun. You may not have gone into this, but on this show, we've looked at some of the doctors and scientists who have examined the connection between fifth generation wireless radiation millimeter wave exposure and the creation of coronavirus inside the body. There was a published report on the National Institute of Health website. They went into detail, a number of Italian scientists went into detail describing how the body, when exposed to fifth generation wireless radiation, will start to manufacture the COVID-19 virus in the process of repairing the damage from millimeter wave exposure, specifically within the liquid area of the nucleus of the cell. And it gets really technical, but I thought that was interesting. I'm wondering if your team of scientists and doctors looked at any of that information.
So, no, and I'll tell you why. You know, that may or may not be true. I have no idea. It's not something that we've dug into. So there's a lot of theories out there. You know, ultimately, for our case, one thing that is really, really critical is we are only including the hardest of science and trying to only use CDC or ODH data wherever possible. And the reason for that is that this is such an amazing thing. We are claiming that essentially these guys have fraudulently misled the public. And we aren't actually suing for fraud or anything of that sort, but you know, they've misrepresented the data. So I didn't want there to be any questions about credibility. There's some great theories out there, and some of them seem to have very great validity. And I'm not going to get into that too much. The reason I'm not getting into it is I don't even need to. I can use their data. I have used their data, and I showed that based on their data, they've misled the public. And also, I've shown that using their data and their words, this is really nowhere near the danger that they've made it out to be. I mean, it couldn't be more clear. The 190,000, 200,000, whatever the number is now that have been claimed to, that they've claimed have died from coronavirus. Well, that's just outright untrue. We have the director of health of the state of Illinois, and we have Dr. Birx both on record saying that that number is the number of people who've died with, not from. And the difference is that means that if you died from a heart attack or got hit by a bus, but you know, someone alleged that you had COVID at the time of death, well, it gets counted as a COVID death. And the standard for a probable COVID death is so low, all it takes, and this is actually straight out of the CDC, so I don't need anyone to tell me that it's made up or been debunked, because it hasn't. It's from their manual, the citations in the case. If you are in an area with continuous ongoing transmission of COVID-19, and you have a cough, you can be diagnosed as a probable COVID-19 case. So if you're dying because you got hit by a bus and you cough fairly persistently, maybe because you got blood in your lungs, you could be legally declared a COVID-19 death. It's just absurd.
The Illinois Department of Public Health director said, as you pointed out, anyone who had COVID-19 at the time of death, even if the person died of other causes, is counted among the COVID deaths. In fact, even if a person is in hospice for other reasons but has COVID too, that death is still counted among the COVID deaths. This was said publicly. That was, I believe, the quote. What does that do in terms of accuracy and efficacy of data, and then decisions are based off of that?
What it does is you got to think about this. Now, I'm not interested in motives because my case is about the Constitution, but you got to think about it this way. When this first started, we passed a bill giving billions of dollars to the CDC to study this dangerous disease, right? You get billions of dollars to study a disease, you think they're going to come back and say, oh, no big deal, nothing to see here, we're going to go away. I mean, of course they're not going to do that. So, you know, they find out and they report what they think they have as a dangerous disease. And you see this spread of misinformation. from there, it's just kind of, it's gone downhill. And the more money that's been thrown at this, the worse it's become. You know, our state and federal governments have thrown such a massive amount of money at this, at fighting this disease, that none of these scientists that are getting all the research grants and all the funding for this, they're not going to come out and say, hey, this really isn't that big of a deal. But the reality is their data, if you dig deep enough and you look at their actual data, if you can find it, because they've hidden a lot of it, you can see that this really is roughly on par, maybe even less dangerous than the seasonal flu. It really is. And that's just based on data. That's just facts. I get a boot out of our governor. He always says, just the science. Well, the science says it's not that dangerous. You know, when you have very few people dying, when you have 0.3% of a chance of a case fatality ratio, that's just not that big of a deal. You are more likely to die of heart disease by far in Ohio. And, you know, yet we haven't shut down McDonald's. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, they're using the data in a very misleading way, and they're doing it in a way to create fear. And they're doing it because they want to keep getting the money. But you never know. I mean, we can debate what they're doing it for. It doesn't really matter to me. Like I said, what they're doing is unconstitutional. So beyond that, I just don't care.
Last month, a judge in Pennsylvania had declared the lockdown orders unconstitutional in the Butler v. Wolf case in federal district court in western Pennsylvania. Does this decision help your case at all?
Well, I think it does. I mean, our case is more aggressive than this. I mean, we're challenging the whole premise for this whole emergency, but we're also challenging a bunch of the orders as well. We're challenging them both collectively and individually in a lot of ways. And, you know, the thing about it is there is zero question that this is unconstitutional. A statewide house arrest there's no question about it being unconstitutional. It's not debatable. It's not maybe. It's just unconstitutional. And we have repeatedly seen, there's a wonderful case, Blaisdell, that was issued in the 30s during the Great Depression, where the court specifically lays out that the Constitution is by no means voided during an emergency. In fact, it becomes even more important because it's during an emergency that we most have to protect our civil rights. And, you know, ultimately, that is the key here. We don't believe there's an emergency. We believe the emergency needs to go away. We don't believe there's ever a very good reason for an emergency. But in any event, it's been over 6 months. There's no curve. We're not worried about the curve. If we're worried about the curve in Ohio, I think you're in New York, you know, you guys had that big hospital ship and all that expanded capacity that you guys built. It's all gone now because you didn't need it. Same thing in Ohio. We built all these places for extra beds because all these people were going to die, except none of them did. We tore it all back down. But the emergency kept on going. Why? If we're doing this to flatten the curve, well, it's flat. I mean, we've seen death rates continue to drop, but I think what they're doing right now is I think they're just hoping that we get a bad flu season, and since nobody's testing for the flu, they can just call all the flu cases COVID and then say, oh, look, it's killing us all. I don't know what else they'd be doing because there's just absolutely nothing to justify this.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is attorney Tom Rentz, who is bringing a large case forward in federal court challenging the pandemic emergency declaration responses. Tom, you're asking the questions that a lot of us are asking, and that is, how is this able to continue? You would have to have a lot of people, you know, in continuity and lockstep with this program to continue it at this level. Do you think a lot of the hospital workers and city administrations around the country, and across the world even, are tricked, are fooled by thinking that this error-prone data is correct?
Well, I think what's happened is you got to remember, healthcare in the United States is consolidated. There's no longer a whole bunch of independent doctors. There's now a whole bunch of doctors that work for big hospital systems. And the individual doctors, you know, they get their information, they get, you know, briefs, they get summaries. And so a lot of them don't have time or energy to dig into this. And what I've found in talking to doctors is you'll get a lot of them. Well, we got this information from the system, from the CDC or from there, or wherever, and it says that this is a big dangerous thing. I said, well, did you look at this and this and this from the CDC or this and this and this? Once they dig into it, they come back to me and say, Tom, man, you were right. This really is unbelievable. So what's happened is, though, that even once they see the light, a lot of them cannot speak out. I mean, we've seen a lot of doctors around the country speak out and lose their jobs. You know, they've been threatened. And that's because the people running these big healthcare systems, and that's an advantage to having centralized healthcare, is that you only have a few people that you need to control. Because if you control them, they fire the people that aren't listening. And that's what we've seen here. That's why some of these doctors that have spoken out have lost their jobs. You know, the data's out there, and the scientists that are out there that are independent and able to evaluate it have all universally agreed with what we're saying. We've got a few people that are very interested parties that are disagreeing with us, and those interested parties are people who are making a lot of money or have the potential to make even more money, are very much in positions of power to facilitate this narrative.
That includes scientists as well.
It certainly does. Remember, if you get $100,000 or $1 million research grant to test and determine how dangerous COVID is, you're not going to get the next one if you say, hey, it's not dangerous. So, you know, that's been the problem. You know, nobody's looking at this, and they aren't giving the grants to the people who are going to come out and say it's not dangerous. Now, we've had plenty of studies that have debunked what's being said. I mean, there are studies out there, but, you know, they're not the well-funded studies from the NIH, which is not a real big surprise because the CDC naturally is not going to come back at this point and say, yeah, we screwed this whole thing up.
I've had conversations with people who are scared and comply with the face mask orders outside and believe the information coming out of the corporate-owned media, such as the Public Health Department rhetoric and the CDC. And I was called a libertarian for bringing up death rate numbers in a conversation. And there's a strategy behind this that uses fear, allowing the majority of population to trust elected officials, essentially to take their rights away. What information have you also found that points to how heavily the populace has been propagandized about COVID-19 cases and death reports?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things that I found when I was going through this, and remember, it always comes back to evidence, and I have to file this in federal court, so if I don't have a good faith belief that what I'm filing is true, I risk my law license. So you can be sure that everything that's filed is cited, and I believe firmly what I've put in front of the court. So, you know, that said, I wouldn't have believed this until I dug into it. But going back to even the 1960s, there's been a train of thought, and it's become common teaching in the field of public health, that the use of fear to create anxiety and to motivate people to do what they need to do is really a well-known tool within the field of public health. Now, that's not to say everybody agrees with it or uses it, but in this particular case, it's a case study on what they do. And you can look this up yourself. I mean, just Google use of fear in public health. You can do it. Use Google Scholar if you don't believe me. You can read the studies yourself. You know, it's something that they realize that if you scare people, they're more likely to listen. And we actually have a presentation that was related to flu vaccinations and creating demand for flu vaccinations from one of the spokesmen from the CDC. And it's older, but it's still very valid. And in that presentation, he talks about if you want to create demand for this vaccine, you need to sow, and he literally used the words, high levels of stress and anxiety in the general public. He said you need to scare people. And that's really what they've done here. And ethically, they tell themselves, well, this will save lives, except for, well, it's not. All you're doing is something that's self-serving here. You know, this is not ethical in any way, shape, or form to lie to the public. Tell the public the truth, and if they're worried about it, let them make their decisions. You know, I find it interesting that you were called a libertarian in a negative way. If not for the people exercising their individual liberties, we wouldn't have civil rights right now. It's civil disobedience. It's people who are speaking out. I mean, that's the core of America. So I hope that same person realized that when he was speaking out against you exercising your liberties and questioning the government, that you were doing the same thing that we're seeing in these protests regarding racial equality, which are a good thing. They deserve the right to speak. They deserve the right to be heard. We don't have to agree on things. We don't have to agree with each other on the details, but we do need to understand that it is our right and our duty to question our government. Now more than ever, that's a critical thing.
Especially in these moments where emergencies are declared. Now, you point listeners to look this up on Google Scholar, and I did a quick search, and there is a paper titled Predicting Public Support for Government Actions in a Public Health Crisis, Testing Fear, Organization-Public Relationship, and Behavioral Intention in the Framework of the Situational Theory of Problem Solving by Mueng Ji Chong and Hyung Park. In one paragraph, it says, in addition, we predict that fear is positively related to the communication actions of publics in the context of public health crisis. Fear has been widely used in risk and health communications because it is a mediator between a perceived threat and fear control response. That's just immediately looking this up.
It doesn't take a lot of digging.
Would you talk about state governments using the power of emergency declarations without significant public scrutiny? And what is the primary criteria for a governor to declare an emergency?
So the criteria can vary state by state. And under the federal constitution, what they're doing is they're claiming it's a 10th Amendment police power issue. Okay, so no one is questioning whether or not a governor can declare an emergency. I also believe that it's better for the states to be able to do it than the federal government. I think it's certainly more constitutional, and where there is a real emergency, it's a necessary power. But an emergency declaration should inherently, in my opinion, be limited to a very short period. After that, if we can't get legislative support for another very short period, we certainly cannot suspend the rights of the executive and judicial branches. And even under an emergency declaration, we can't suspend the U.S. Constitution. So what's happening here, and this is kind of getting into the legal weeds, is you really have kind of a debate between the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment. You know, whose rights are greater, the individuals or the state governments? Now, I don't think there's really any question about the answer to that based on our Constitution and how it's been interpreted over the past couple centuries. You know, the individual rights are something that were always fundamental in our country. And the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are really limiting. They're there to limit government actions and government authority. So anytime that there's a question, I think it's safe to say that we should be ruling in favor of the individual. That's how we made so many strides in terms of civil rights and things like that over the years, is we've recognized that individual rights are our Constitution, our founding fathers, everything. So that's a critical thing. It's an important thing. Now, what the states have done is, because this has never really been fully tested, because no one ever would have thought that in America they were just going to, you know, tell everybody you're under house arrest, go home. The states have used the fact that that hasn't been tested to just go completely off the deep end here and exercise powers that no government official in the United States has ever had authority to do constitutionally.
And I find what's interesting here is, despite corrections and adjustments made in the numbers of COVID deaths by maybe alternative media, and it's supported right from government agencies such as the CDC, no significant changes are made. There aren't any real adjustments being made by the corporate-owned media. I'm sure you're seeing this as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Part of this whole process, and it's enumerated, if you look at the CDC's Emergency Response Crisis Manual, or if you look at the document that I referenced before from the CDC Communications Director, part of the strategy in creating a fear response is to partner with the media. I mean, that's an intentional thing. Now, whether the media is intentionally allowing it to happen or they've been duped, I don't know. But there's no question that this is an intentional thing. I mean, I've got the paperwork that shows it. This isn't even up for debate. This is just an obvious thing that's been done very effectively. Now, my question, and I think the greater question, is why aren't there more people like you in the media, investigative journalists that actually investigate? You know, we've seen a few good guys, John Rappaport and a few of these others, like, and you, who are actually asking questions. But with the exception of those people, and you guys are called alternative media, what you guys are is actually investigative journalists in the traditional sense. You actually investigate, and then you journalize it. The traditional media, I mean, I know one paper locally put two stories out on me with numerous quotes and has never spoke to me. I don't know how they would have got my quotes without talking to me, but they certainly had a bunch of them. And then it gets picked up by other papers. It's unbelievable. So, yeah, I don't think that's a real complicated answer. I think it's just people, they've got their own interests, they do their own thing, and to hell with the truth.
Unfortunately, those voices are the ones that the majority of the people listen to and make decisions off of, and they are disseminating the information that come through the government agencies. And other alternative sources, I would say, and thank you for that. I appreciate you mentioning me. There is the Corbett Report, who does a really great job, and Del Bigtree on the High Wire. He's really good. And Jason Goodman, Bonnie Faulkner. There are a number of really good independent journalists. KPFK out there, Question Everything. Tony Bates is doing that out there in Los Angeles. Now, I understand you want to have a jury trial for this case. What are the advantages to a jury trial?
Well, you know, I think that the judicial system usually gets it right, but I'm very eager to put this in front of a jury of my peers and see what we can come up with. I don't think this is complicated. I think it really adds credibility to what we're doing. And I think the real problem has not been that people can't get it. It's that they've been misled. I mean, there are brilliant people out there that have fallen hook, line, and sinker for this. No question about it. So I think having a jury of regular people hear this and come out with a ruling on it, I think that's valuable, because I think that it allows people to say, these are just regular people and they came up with this conclusion. How did they do that? There's no question. You know, I keep hearing in the media, oh, this decision was politically biased. This is, you know, maybe, maybe not. I think most decisions, it's really hard to judge a judicial decision from the outside, and it's really easy to play it in the media for something different than what it is. So, you know, I don't necessarily believe that it's the case that so many decisions are politically biased. I do think there's some bad decisions, for sure. That does happen. But I think more times than not, the American judiciary gets it right. But doing it this way really, I think, adds credibility. And it's such an important thing, because people are scared. They've been lied to. And we need to make sure that that's set right. So that's kind of the thinking.
People are scared, and they are lied to, and they trusted those people to tell them the truth and not be deceived. It's going to make people very, very angry, Tom, and I'm sure you're expecting to see some of this as the case goes forward and exposes more information. Would you talk about the importance of the discovery process here in the case and filing FOIA requests?
Discovery is a judicial process. So when we go to court, the theory is that we're all trying to get to justice. So we should share the facts that are relevant and allow them to be made a part of the case so that everybody can evaluate them and determine, you know, what is justice. And facts are facts in theory. So you can't hide things. And the wonderful thing about discovery is everybody gets to see the same facts. So the thing about that is we've had infinite numbers of FOIA requests ignored around the country. And in Ohio, we've had tons of them ignored. We've actually had sitting members of our legislature send in requests for information to the Ohio Department of Health and the governor and just been ignored. How can they make policy decisions without the information? But, you know, the worst part is why are they being ignored? It's not hard to send this information. You have these models. You have this data. All you have to do is click attach and send. And you've done the email and it's done. Why not make it public? You know, and my real question is, and I really look forward to discovery, because the thing is if you don't have anything to hide, why are you hiding it? If this is really that dangerous, put it out, make it public, embarrass me so that I go away, and then you don't have to worry about it anymore. Don't tell me you didn't have time to click attach and send. That's nonsense. It would spend 6 months. You've had plenty of time to click attach and send. You've had time to throw our rights away. You've had time to discriminate against seniors. You've had time to scare people, but you haven't had time to click attach and send. I find that just incredible. I would hope that if there is anything honest about this at all, anything, that there are absolutely no objections to discovery, the state, the CDC, and all the associated entities that we're going to be asking questions to openly give us this data, they share it, and they welcome the opportunity to make it public. And ODH and all these people, they put out all the information, all the data, and it's not biased. There's no lies. They just put out the true and honest information. And it turns out that everything that I've said was wrong and that they were actually telling the truth. I'll issue a public apology. I'll go away. I'll be embarrassed. And everything will be fine for them, and they will have saved the world. I don't think that's going to happen, though. I truly don't think that's going to happen. They've been hiding this information. And as I said, you don't hide it if you don't have anything to hide.
I think this case is going to be a very important model for other attorneys to examine and look at as potentially, and hopefully, they start to bring in their own states and it becomes more of an inspiration. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. One of the big issues is that I will tell you, I myself have over 2,000 hours in this case. That is not an amount of time that any normal person could afford to pay an attorney to do. You know, the thing about that is that this case is probably unaffordable for most people. So what? It needed to be filed, right? We need to do this. The great advantage to what we're doing is the further I get in the case, the less expensive it is to file elsewhere. So we have a bunch of people around the country that are reaching out to me and saying, we want to file this, and they're welcome to. And I encourage them to, you know, fight for their rights and do their things. What I will say, though, is we're getting ready to enter discovery. Give me some time to get some data, and it will save you money. Plus, we're doing it. So if we win, well, you can use everything we did and do it everywhere. If we lose, you can say, well, you know, this is where he blew it. And do it better. I want our country free, and I'm not going to tell anybody I'm the greatest lawyer in the country. I'm just a regular guy from a small town in Ohio, and I'm a guy who believes that we should be free, or at least that our government has a duty to be honest to us. And that's not been happening. They can't take our rights away on a lie. And, you know, the thing that I ask the people who say, well, it's not that big of a deal, you should go along with it. I said, well, what happens when they take away a right that you care about? What if in the future we get a governor or someone who's an official that's a monster and does something terrible, takes away civil rights? How about that? We get a racist governor or something horrible, something unthinkable like that. Well, are you going to care then? Are you going to say we should just go along with it? Yeah, we can't pick and choose which freedoms we fight for. We either want to be a free country and have the right to march, the right to assemble, the right to speak out, the right to travel, the right to do all of these different things, just to go to work and earn a living, or we don't. But you can't have both, because you never know who's going to be in charge next. And do you really want to trust whoever's in charge next to have the authority to take these rights away? And my feeling on it is absolutely not. I don't trust people, not with something that important.
If lockdowns go without question or any kind of scrutiny, it's definitely possible it sets a precedent. Regarding being a regular guy, an attorney in Ohio, well, you have some unwavering courage and you're uncompromised, and I think that's in short supply right now. Tom, would you talk about the witnesses you're working with and give listeners a general idea, if you can, of what they're going to bring to the case.
Yeah, so, you know, I got a few people. I'll tell you one guy that you might want to look into is Dr. Peter Bragan. He wrote a treatise on this, and he's actually out in New York State as well. Brilliant guy, Harvard-educated psychiatrist. And I love Peter. He and his wife, Ginger, are amazing, and they've done just incredible work on this. And one of the things that's really interesting, and the reason I bring up Peter first, is this. Peter is in his 80s. So if Peter was to fall or to hurt himself or anything of the sort and ended up in a nursing home, he wouldn't have the authority to make a decision whether he wanted to see his family or not. This is a guy who wrote a treatise on this. His work is brilliant. He's done so many things. He's a brilliant, brilliant man and scientist, but yet the state has decided that he wouldn't have authority to decide whether or not he wants to make a decision to, I want to see my family. How is that right? So we have people like Peter. We have some other very brilliant people, you know, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. We have a brilliant scientist, Dr. Doug Frank. We've got a whole bunch of others. You know, I'll be sharing a lot more as the trial progresses. And what they're going to testify to is depends on the person, right? So we're going to testify to the total inefficacy of masks. They've been around forever. And by the way, for anyone who doesn't know this, these things have been studied endlessly because they're used in operations and surgeries. Doctors have been using masks forever. And for those that don't remember, when this all started, everybody said, don't wear a mask. You don't need it. It won't do any good. They don't do any good. If you go back to the old studies, and we've got this all laid out, they don't do any good. They aren't going to help. They aren't going to do anything. The only thing they're going to do is if someone's going to sneeze on you, they'll stop that. And that's a good thing, that it's stopping that. But beyond that, they aren't going to do anything. And I'm going to be honest, if you sneeze on me, I'm going to probably want to smack you anyways. That's disgusting. You shouldn't be doing that. And if you're that rude, there's greater problems. So the masks are a waste. We're going to be talking about the masks. We're going to be talking about a lot about the deaths and the case fatality rates and the fact that it's been so much misleading information. We're going to be talking about the cases and the fact that the testing doesn't work, the fact that there's not actually any effective testing out there, and that the whole thing is just garbage. We're going to talk a lot about people's rights, why their rights should be preserved, and why an emergency doesn't give you the right to throw the Constitution out the window. We're going to be talking about a lot of very interesting things. You know, they've hit this from so many directions. They said that everybody was dying, and the case fatality rate dropped so low that they didn't want to talk about that anymore. So then they moved on to excess deaths. Well, the excess deaths are primarily due to what they've done locking down people and their reaction to COVID, not COVID itself. COVID itself hasn't caused excess deaths so much as, you know, putting people in nursing homes and that are infected so that you can kill old people. You know, those sort of things have caused excess deaths. ODs, drugs, violence, those things have caused excess deaths. But those are all attributable to the lockdowns and the things that have been done to prevent this disease.
You were mentioning that, Tom, and also rewriting coroner's procedures regarding COVID-19 cases. Would you tell listeners about that?
Yeah, so the coroner's handbook was last revised in 2003. There has been one revision made since then, and that was when COVID came along. And COVID is the only disease that is recorded the way that it is. So when we talk about these 200,000 deaths, the reason that they've been able to get to that number is because they changed the way that they account for dying in one case, and that is deaths related to COVID-19. So this is the only disease that is written up this way on death certificates, and it makes no sense because no other diseases or anything else are done this way. So one change since 2003. If I didn't know, if I didn't have the CDC documents to back that, I would say that's got to be a conspiracy theory, but it's not a theory when it's a fact, because it's clearly been done. I have the documents. We submitted them to the court. So it's not arguable. It's just reality.
Attorney Tom Rentz, this case will hopefully be a model used by attorneys across the United States and Canada to parse out the COVID-19 data so administrations from the local to federal can use factual information to base their decisions. Meanwhile, there's immeasurable psychological damage, as you're pointing out, to reverse, and hopefully those exposed for their involvement with this deception will be held responsible. If listeners want to reach you and support your work, how would they do that?
Well, we've got links on rens-law.com, that's my website, to some of the groups supporting us, and we're still putting some of this together, to be honest. This is as grassroots as it could possibly be. I mean, we don't have big corporate sponsors or any giant groups supporting us. We're just regular people who really want to be free again. So some of this is under development, and you'll have to bear with us on that. But we're working with a group called Make America Free Again, which is a great group. That's Pam Popper's group. And then Ohio Stands Up is the group that actually started this all. That was put together by my plaintiffs to try and help get this together and organized and manage, and they're just incredible people. These people are heroes. My co-counsel, Bob Gargas, my intern, my volunteers, my plaintiffs, these people are American heroes who are willing to take the abuse and all the nonsense that goes with a high-profile case and still just do what they need to stand up for our freedoms and our rights. So, you know, I'm a privileged man to be able to work with these people and to support them, and to try and fight for the freedoms that our soldiers and police and all these people spend risk their lives to protect every day.
Well, it's going to be exciting to watch this case gain momentum, and I really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you so much.
Honored to be here. I appreciate you helping me get the truth out.
That was attorney Tom Rentz. I'll put links to his site and the complaint on inothernewsradio.com. That's inothernewsradio.com. You have to include the radio. As you've heard, the basic freedoms of people living in this country are at stake based on the manipulation of medical data and statistics. It will be very important to pay attention to this case, especially as it moves to discovery. I would imagine attorney Tom Rentz and those working for him right now could use a lot of support. If you have any questions about this show or any others, you can reach me by email, and that is inothernewsradio@yahoo.com. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.